Hi, this is Ronan Levy. I'm one of the co-founders and the executive chairman of Field Trip Health Limited, and you're listening to Professionally Psychedelics.
Where do they go? The smoke rings I blow each night.
Oh, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the pod today Ronan Levy, founder and executive chairman of Field Trip Health Limited. He has had a fascinating career to date, notably as a pioneer first in the cannabis space, co-founding the Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX, which were later acquired by Aurora. He then moved on to blazing trails in psychedelics, co-founding Field Trip, one of the first psychedelic companies to list on the stock markets. It is fair to say that he is an absolute champion of both fields and someone that we are delighted to be speaking with. So with all that in mind, Ronan, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you for having me. You make me feel really good about myself right now with all those kind words, and you do it with such vigor that it's really nice. Thank you.
Well, we're glad you feel that way. And so in the spirit of that good mood, what led you to psychedelic medicine?
You know, it was a convergence of things that led to us starting Field Trip. Personally speaking, I've done a lot of work, not with psychedelics per se, but with meditation, self-reflection, metaphysics, all that kind of stuff, therapy, coaching for many years, since probably my mid-20s or so. So thinking in terms of mental health, mental well-being, emotional health and emotional well-being was something that I was very comfortable with in the first place. And then it really was a confluence of things that happened. So I was not very familiar with psychedelics or cannabis, to be quite honest, back in 2013 when we started Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX. When we got into the cannabis industry, our perspective was pretty flexible. You know, we were just ambitious entrepreneurs. We didn't have any particular affiliations to cannabis, any particular predilections or enjoyment of cannabis. I had tried it a handful of times. It really wasn't my thing. Most of my co-founders in the last business weren't terribly experienced in cannabis either, but we were very open-minded. Certainly, we thought the war on drugs philosophically didn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we were very comfortable with starting a business in the medical cannabis industry. You know, I'd be honest in saying that we were agnostic at best as to the therapeutic potential of cannabis at the time. But philosophically, we thought it was still something that was safe and potentially beneficial. So we were all for getting into the industry. And then we started those businesses, Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Cannabis RX, and it totally blew our minds in terms of the therapeutic potential of cannabis. You know, we helped probably close to 150,000 Canadians access the legal medical cannabis system through our clinics. At our peak, you know, 1 in 3 of every medical cannabis patients in Canada was coming through our clinics. And we were focused on doing really good medicine. You know, our medical director, Dr. Barry Weisglass, he was very, very progressive, but he was also very disciplined in working on ensuring that we were doing good medicine, seeing really good results, doing it in a way that could generate the buy-in of the broader medical community. And so the patients we treated were not what most people expected. It wasn't, you know, 22-year-old tattooed kids who wanted access to cannabis with legal cover. These were genuinely sick people, generally cannabis naive people who were at the end of their ropes. They had tried everything for their chronic conditions and were not finding any success. And cannabis turned out to be truly a godsend for many of these people. Almost uniformly, all of our doctors, even though many of them came in pretty skeptical, reported very quickly that cannabis medicine was the single most effective therapeutic agent that they had ever prescribed in their lives. The patient response was amazing as well. You know, we'd have people come back to us and say, listen, the cannabis did nothing for my back pain, but I slept through the night for the first time in 7 years. And that alone has made such a difference in my life that I'm grateful for everything that you do. And so it really touched us quite personally what plant-based medicines could do, or more accurately, I guess, stigmatized medicines could do. After we sold that business to Aurora, we spent a couple of years building Aurora. which had at the time of the acquisition only recently been licensed in Canada. And so we took active management roles within Aurora and helped build Aurora to be one of the largest global producers of both adult use and medical cannabis. Spent a couple of years doing that and then left in 2018, middle of 2018, to start pursuing something new. And that's right around the time that we learned about psychedelics and what was happening in the space. I had recalled that Peter Thiel had made an investment in something around psilocybin, but I didn't really know what was happening. But we ended up having a meeting with an entrepreneur named Judy Bloomstock, who is the CEO of a company called Diamond Therapeutics. She was looking to raise capital. Diamond Therapeutics was focused on developing novel formulations of psilocybin. So not dissimilar to Compass Pathways. We didn't end up investing in Diamond. It wasn't the right fit for us at the time, but she opened our eyes to a lot of the things that were emerging in the psychedelic space. You know, Michael Pollan had just published How to Change Your Mind. MAPS had recently been granted breakthrough therapy designation by the FDA. Amazingly to me at the time, she pointed us to a couple of online stores that were openly selling psilocybin mushrooms in Canada. You know, not dark web. This was World Wide Web, openly selling mushrooms to people. And I was like, okay, there's something really happening here. And based on what we saw with cannabis and how quickly attitude shifted, I was like, this is something that's real. And then Judy described in our meeting that a single psilocybin assisted therapy session is like 10 years of therapy in an afternoon. And going back to the initial kind of comment I made, having done a lot of work with therapy and coaching and meditation, I know just how profoundly impactful that could be. And so even if what she said was a massive exaggeration, which it turns out doesn't seem like it is, but even if it was, if psychedelics could be the platform that got people thinking about their mental health, like they think about their physical fitness, which is they do it on a proactive basis. We all know going to the gym and working out makes us stronger and healthier and makes us happier and live longer. We don't all do it, but we recognize that we should. With mental health, it really is still quite reactive and passive. We only pursue our mental health and our mental well-being once we're depressed, once we're anxious, once we experience trauma. And if psychedelics could be the platform that just shifted that conversation where we think about mental health and well-being and emotional health and well-being into something that's a proactive pursuit, you know, I realized there was nothing more impactful I could do in this world than that. And so, you know, I bought in almost immediately. It took us a while to figure out how to turn this opportunity into a business. It took us, I think we spent 6 to 9 months just trying to reflect and understand what the potential was. But after a while, we kind of coalesced around a business model, and out of that, Field Trip was born.
And I'd love to touch upon that last thing you mentioned, sort of looking at the business model that you would be working with for the new venture. How did you and your leadership team go about ascertaining what a good business in this space would look like, especially being quite new to the space at the time?
Yeah, so we, you know, the psychedelic industry is still quite small, but 2.5-3 years ago, it was that much smaller.
Yeah.
And so you could just send a cold email to Michael Pollan and get a response. You could send a cold email to Rick Goblin and get a response. And so we did. We spoke to Rick. We spoke to Michael. We spoke to the folks at Beckley, who are now part of Beckley SciTech, Cosmo and Amanda, and they were all very generous with their time. And the feedback we heard from them was that there's no money in psychedelic drugs, but you need new clinical infrastructure to make this industry work. That's where the money is going to be made. That's the essential infrastructure that needs to exist that doesn't exist. So look there. And having built a large scale network of medical clinics in a stigmatized medicine area like cannabis, we realized that we had a unique skill set to bring to bear in making this happen. And so we started spending a lot of time thinking about that. Do we open up centers of excellence that don't actually treat people, that are just education centers? Because we kind of looked forward and we realized that there was going to be a convergence between the research and the science and the progress on the clinical trials and the demand, which was growing, and they would intersect. And so just by being out there, there would be a business model to be had at some point in the future. And was it worth investing the capital just to kind of build that mind share and to try and do a land grab? And then we kind of stumbled upon a couple of other things, that ketamine was being used as a mental health treatment, mostly through an infusion model, treating it like an antidepressant. But it just happens to turn out that ketamine works very similarly to classical psychedelics, both in terms of its mechanism of action and the overall experience. And so we realized, oh, okay, we don't have to just build centers of excellence that really stand there and educate people. We can start treating people now and build a model around ketamine-assisted psychotherapy until the classic psychedelics come along. And so that started down one path for us, which is now Field Trip, our operating division, which is Field Trip Health. We have locations in Toronto, New York, LA, Chicago, Atlanta. We've announced that we'll be building in San Diego and Houston, as well as Amsterdam, providing ketamine-assisted therapy. Actually, in Amsterdam, we can provide psilocybin-assisted therapy using psilocybin truffles. And we'll continue to expand that clinical network. But we also happen to realize that there are some jurisdictions in which psychedelics are, I'll say legal, more accurately, not illegal. Jamaica is one of those jurisdictions. And we had great relationships with people in Jamaica through our work in the cannabis industry. And as we looked out, we realized that there are a lot of parallels that are drawn between cannabis and psychedelics, and some of them are appropriate and some of them are not. But one of the appropriate comparisons between the two is that psychedelics will operate similarly to cannabis in that there will be a purely medical side of the industry, and there will be it's not recreational, it's more wellness focused, but a more state by state kind of rollout like we saw in cannabis. So you're going to have medicine and then you're going to have wellness, and these are two systems that are going to operate in parallel, and that wellness system is probably going to rely on mushrooms and the natural products much more so than the synthetic form of the medical system. And so, having known from the cannabis industry that there's such a thing as an entourage effect, and that scaling cultivation of cannabis and presumably mushrooms is not as easy as just building a bigger box and getting to it, that there's a lot of sophistication and complication in doing so, we realized that we could get a head start on cultivation work in Jamaica. So we partnered with the University of West Indies and recently opened the first permanent establishment for the research and cultivation of psilocybin-producing mushrooms and plant-based psychedelics, really with a view to basic science, but also developing cultivation techniques. So as states like Oregon and potentially California and Florida and Hawaii and potentially Canada as well start to come online with access to the natural products, we would be in a uniquely qualified position not only to build out the clinical infrastructure, but also to build out the cultivation side of things. And out of that, Field Trip Discovery was born. And I'll continue to tell the story, and I apologize for being long-winded, but I'll give you the full perspective. One of the things we also learned very carefully, quite quickly from the cannabis industry is, as well as we did on the sale of Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Cannabis RX to Aurora, on that sale, it was great. You know, our shareholders generated great return. The real value accretion happened on the production side of things. So we didn't want to miss that opportunity. And looking forward, we're like, okay, there's probably going to be a wellness system and a medical system. There's going to be one of them for sure. We don't want to make a mistake and bet only on the wellness side of things, because that seems less likely to roll out, but it seems like a virtual certainty that these clinical trials, based on the evidence that they're showing, are going to succeed at some point. So we also wanted to get actively involved in drug development. And so our work with drug development started, you know, about a year or so ago when we hired our chief science officer, Dr. Nathan Bryson, who quickly developed what we think is one of the best strategies around drug development in the psychedelic space. And our work with FT-104, which is our novel psychedelic molecule in development, started underway.
So let's talk about FT-104, because I think a lot of people will know Field Trip perhaps more for their clinics. All around North America, Canada, US, and one in Amsterdam, just to make sure you get your full kudos. But I think the drug development story might be perhaps a little bit more exciting or racy. So let's look at it this way. Firstly, why do we need new psychedelics? Because there's a lot out there that aren't being used. And what's special about this one?
Sure. There are a lot of psychedelics, and they are, you know, MDMA and psilocybin and DMT and all these molecules seem to be quite wonderful molecules with a lot of potential to help a lot of people really improve the quality of their lives, not only in terms of treating depression and mental health conditions, but also in terms of all of the pro-social side effects associated with psychedelics, which I don't think get enough of a shout out. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. But the biggest challenge with anything in the psychedelics industry right now is the very long time frames associated with classic psychedelic experiences, which with psilocybin, you're probably looking at least 4 to 6 hours in a clinic, MDMA, 6 to 8 hours in a clinic. And in a medicalized context where you need a doctor as well as professional therapist, as well as the space, you know, the importance of set and setting, it's really expensive. You know, there's no cheap way, or inexpensive way, I suppose is the more accurate term, to deliver these therapies when you require so much professional time to provide the oversight and care necessary around it.
Well, what about DMT? Because I feel like that might be a more appropriate length of time.
DMT is a much shorter time frame, but it's also like blasting off to the moon, right? It's a very intense experience, which is probably not well suited for the uninitiated, right? So we kind of looked and said, listen, psilocybin is wonderful. You know, the experience is pretty gentle. The therapeutic outcomes, very positive. The safety profile, incredibly high. Is there a way that we could offer a psilocybin-like experience in a way that is much shorter, in 2 to 3 hours as opposed to 4 to 6 hours? And so we canvassed all the known literature, both scientific and academic, as well as the anecdotal and the online trip reports, and realized that there was an opportunity to work with a molecule that offered a much shorter time frame, but an experience very similar to psilocybin in terms of its aesthetic effects. And in fact, it turns out in terms of its binding capacity to the various receptors in the brain. But there were also challenges in terms of its solubility. You know, it's a great experience, but it's not very easy to convert into an effective medical drug that can be administered on a consistent, you know, basis with proper bioavailability and all that kind of stuff. And so what Nathan did is he did some chemistry with that molecule, and through a prodrug strategy, essentially attaching other molecules to it, we significantly increased the solubility of this underlying molecule, which adding this other moiety to the underlying molecule became FT-104. So now we have this great molecule that through our preclinical studies, we've confirmed binds almost identically to psilocybin in the brain, washes out of the system in 2 to 3 hours, and the experience and the blood plasma levels are pretty closely correlated. So once it's out of your system, the trip is over. But it has IP around it as well, because we've enhanced the molecule in a way that differentiates it from what's known and existing. So we've got this great molecule that's psilocybin-like, much shorter time frame, thus addressing those challenges around cost and time commitment associated with psychedelic therapies. And there's IP around it, so we actually have a defensible business model, which is one of the biggest challenges with some of the other companies out there, is that if you don't have robust IP around your molecule like psilocybin or LSD, then maybe you get data exclusivity through the Hatch-Waxman Act in the US and equivalent kind of legislation in Europe and Canada. But after 3 to 5 years, that exclusivity goes away and you're going to be dealing with generic competitors. Because we have a patent on FT-104, and you know that time frame extends to 14 years as opposed to the 3 to 5 years under mm-hmm. Hatch-Waxman. So it really is kind of the best of all worlds, a great experience, a shorter time frame, and IP. You know, it checks all the boxes for what we think is going to be a very successful, very impactful psychedelic drug in the medical space.
I imagine the fact that you guys have got IP around it is very exciting to investors. And perhaps that's something we can touch on a bit later on the investment side. But something I'd be keen to ask you around the discussion on this molecule at the moment. And that is, what is the sort of next steps and route to, I guess, administration and application for a molecule like this? Now that you have developed it, you've got your IP, you've got your patent down, what are the sort of the next few steps which are precursors to effectively having patients benefit from this?
Yeah, you know, as with any drug approval process, it's a long and expensive process, but actually quite a bit shorter than the path that most other companies have taken. So it's one of the things that we're also quite excited about with our strategy. We're still doing our preclinical work, and based on the indication that we propose to pursue, we're not committed to it yet. We think we can get through phase 3 and get approvals to start marketing and selling FT-104 by about 2026. And it's actually great because we focused on trying to get a really strong first mover or early mover advantage in building out our clinical infrastructure so we could build the brand with Field Trip Health. But with Field Trip Discovery, our division that's focused on the drug development and cultivation work in Jamaica, there's an advantage to being a second mover here because MAPS and Compass Pathways are going to do a lot of the heavy lifting and hard work in terms of establishing what needs to be demonstrated to get FDA approval for a drug. And with our strategy, which we think will require less timeframes in terms of clinical trials based on this indication, we think we could probably get through our phase three clinical trials and into market within about a year of Compass Pathways psilocybin. So they'll have done all of the hard work, for which we're grateful for, and then we'll come out with a product that we think is going to be more persuasive because it will be more accessible and more affordable based on the shorter timeframes and thus lower costs associated with it. But that's still, you know, five, six years away. So like I said, next steps for us are trying to get into phase one human trials by the end of this year, and then through phase three by about 2025, and hopefully ultimately approval and marketing by 2026.
How does the development process work for something like this? Because when I think of, say, Alexander Shulgin and sort of Tikal and Fecal and generally people who try and synthesize psychoactive molecules, there's a lot of self-experimentation that goes on, but I feel like that would be a lot harder in a listed company that's just taken in a big investment round and with far more regulations to deal with. So how do you get to the stage where you're even ready to go for trials in humans?
Yeah, so you know, that's one of the genius things that Nathan did and we've established in our preclinical work. So what happens when FT-104 is administered is that the moiety that we've added to the molecule cleaves off. And so that underlying psychedelic molecule, you know, which is documented reasonably well in some of the literature, reemerges. And that's all that's left. You know, the other molecule is just a natural product. It's non-toxic. So your body just metabolizes it like normal. And then you have this underlying psychedelic molecule. So, you know, even before we administered it to rats or any human will experience it, we know because of the way it gets metabolized that you're just going to have the experience of the underlying psychedelic molecule. It is a novel molecule, but because of this cleaving, the experiences with a known psychedelic. You know, if it was an entirely different molecule that started engaging with the brain, then it would be less certain as to what the experience is like. But that's not the case with FT-104, and part of the reason we're so excited about it.
Okay, well, I'll believe you that this molecule is going to be the one, and I look very much forward to it coming out and seeing the results.
Sorry, it's just like, I mean, psilocybin, people talk about psilocybin. Psilocybin is actually a prodrug, right? That when you ingest psilocybin, what happens is it cleaves, I think, a phosphate molecule, and the underlying molecule that actually has the psychoactivity is psilocin. And so that's the same thing with FT-104 here. That FT-104 is the prodrug, and then once you ingest it, it cleaves the moiety that we've added, and so you just have the underlying psychedelic. So
it sort of is like cracks in half and releases like a Kinder egg the good stuff, as it's technically known.
That's exactly right. I love Kinder eggs.
So let's talk about what this means for your most recent investment round, because this has got to be one of the largest investments in the psychedelic space. So I'd love to talk about what, when you went out to investors, what were you discussing? Probably a bit of this. Who were the investors? What were they like? What did they want to see? And really just talk us through the process of raising nearly $100 million for a psychedelic business, which would have been unthinkable 5 years ago almost.
Yeah. You know, we had great support. So Bloom Burton, which is a Canadian biotech bank, has been a good friend of Field Trip since day one. They've been, you know, an avid supporter, both vocally as well as providing great advice since the early days. And so after we finished our bought deal in January of this year, where we raised $20 million working with Stiefel and Canaccord, and made some progress on our drug development efforts, because Bloom Burton was so close to us, they're like, we want to set you up on a roadshow with some of the most well-established and well-known biotech investors, because we think they're going to be quite interested in what you're doing with FT-104. Now, a number of these biotech investors had also invested in, say, Compass Pathways. And so in February, we started doing a non-deal roadshow, having meetings with these biotech funds. And we've been very selective about what we disclose, but for a few of them who showed a lot of interest and really have the caliber and the strength of an investor that we thought would be meaningful to the future of Field Trip, we kind of signed an NDA and took them behind the curtain to show them exactly what FT-104 was and some of the preclinical results, and the response was just amazing. I think in one of the meetings, someone described our drug development strategy as the best idea they'll see all year. And as it was only February, we took that as a great a sign of validation. And so it came together rather quickly, you know, and a few of the funds, I'd be happy to share them, but not all of them necessarily want to be disclosed. So I'll be selective. But, you know, these are some of the most well-known, well-established, well-credentialed biotech investors in the United States came in and they wrote big checks. So even though we hadn't set out to raise $95 million initially, we were just setting out to raise about $50 million to advance our drug development work. Based on the caliber of the investors and the size of the investments they wanted, we took a lot more than we initially expected, but it's great validation. We live in a world where the stock market is, I guess, in the last week or so, retrenched a little bit, but the volatility is a little concerning. So if we can get to a place where our next couple of years are well-financed, so we don't have to worry about the volatility in the market, it really strengthens our overall viability as a business. And so we were happy to take more than we set out to, especially because of the quality of the investors that we brought in.
And with the, I guess, excess $45 million that you hadn't budgeted for, are you guys now looking at perhaps any new or additional projects that you hadn't previously forecasted, or is this more of a operational buffer for you at the moment?
It's mostly an operational buffer. We have a couple of other molecules that we're exploring and may add to our pipeline. So it will also give us some breathing room to advance those as well. But one of the things we want to make sure, one of the mistakes we want to make sure we don't repeat from the cannabis industry is that the psychedelic stock market industry right now is quite frothy. And we don't want to get into the game of acquiring overvalued businesses just to sort of keep up with the excitement, because that, I think, destroyed a lot of value in the cannabis industry. So we're very focused on, executing on our existing business model, trying not to get distracted by some of the bright, shiny objects that may get a lot of, stock market excitement, and just execute, because we think we have a very persuasive, coherent business model. We've got a great molecule in FT-104, and the other molecules we're looking at are quite promising as well. Mm-hmm. And so really it's about keeping our head down, trying to accelerate some of our clinic openings for sure. We'll certainly put a little bit more marketing budget around our app Trip. But other than that, it's really just about full steam ahead and not getting distracted by what's happening around us.
I think it's wise to retain some of a war chest for if the markets are less frothy Q4, Q3, which I think a lot of people could imagine being the case. But what do you think, rather than the markets, is the future for psychedelics?
Yeah, this is what I get really excited about. I think psychedelics are going to fundamentally change so many paradigms about our society. And not a total, sorry, like I said fundamentally, that's probably not the best word. It's not going to be totally revolutionary. It's not going to be a repeat of the 60s where, where people are like, let's throw LSD in like the water supply and make sure that John Kennedy and Stalin get dosed with LSD, it'll solve all the world's problems. It's going to be incremental. What I think we're going to see is that a mental health care and treating mental health diagnoses is going to fundamentally change with psychedelics becoming the primary form. It's just much more integrative. I think, most people recognize, I believe, that mental health and mental well-being and emotional health and emotional well-being is not just a function of our neurochemistry, that there's emotions, there's the spirit, there's the human experience that has an essential component of it. And that's why, when we talk about psychedelic therapies, it's actually psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. We're not using the drug as a solution. We're using it as a catalyst to enhance the quality of the psychotherapy. So you have both the neurochemistry operating as well as the emotional processing, the opportunities and the neuroplasticity that comes from the neurochemistry to make people's lives better, to change habits, to change outlooks, to change mindset. It's the integration of both the changing of the lifestyle and changing of the attitudes, plus the neurochemical considerations that lead to these amazing outcomes that we're seeing. At least that's the current thinking, right? And as that starts to play out, and as people, recognize that the limitations of conventional Western allopathic medicine, which is just focused on treating what's wrong, starts to move into a more integrative model where A, we do treat what's wrong. That's certainly important, but we start to work to treat what's right and enhance the quality of our lives through medicine. I think psychedelic medicine is going to start to take a much more important role at the forefront of our healthcare. That because of the deep trusting relationships that start to emerge between, you know, a therapist or a therapy team in a psychedelic therapy setting and a patient, that trust rapport is going to be deep and significant. And because of that neuroplasticity, because of that changing attitudes and opportunities, we as Field Trip or we as the people providing psychedelic therapies are going to be in a unique position to help people make real lifestyle changes. And so I foresee a world in where the family doctor, you know, who at least in Canada, I can't speak to the experience elsewhere, and I have a great deal of respect for my family doctor. He's wonderful. He gives way more time and attention than he probably should to my issues. But at the end of the day, I still see him like for 15 minutes and then I get hurried out, right? Whereas the relationship that you're going to build with your psychedelic therapy provider is going to be very deep and very trusting. And so I think people will start to look to their psychedelic health provider or their mental health provider, which will rely primarily on psychedelics, as the triage point to help them make decisions around, you know, general health, what doctors they should go to. I think I foresee a future where your psychedelic therapist becomes like your GP. That's the primary triage point. They're not going to do the diagnosing or prescribing about, you know, if you have an infection or, you know, you're so tired that you can't get out of bed or anything along those lines, but they're going to help point you in the right directions and make lifestyle changes as well as point you in a direction to make informed medical decisions as well. And I think that's going to have a huge impact on so many things that we don't treat our lives as something that's reactive. We treat it proactively. We're constantly striving to feel better, you know, be more aware, be more conscious. And when we put that at the forefront of how we think about our healthcare, I think it changes a lot of things. And that's one of the things that's so exciting. You know, I touched on it before about how psychedelics are going to put mental health as something that we do proactively. But I actually think it goes beyond that, where I think it becomes, we focus on our mental health at first instance and let the physical health follow from that, because more and more what we're seeing is that mental and emotional health and physical health are deeply related, not just in terms of the psychology, but, you know, physically. We know that gut health has a significant impact on brain health as well and all that kind of stuff. So I do foresee a future where it's possible. I'm not saying this is a certainty, but I do see it as very possible where, you know, your mental health and your emotional health provider is your first point of contact for almost all other medical health decisions going forward. I know that seems pretty outlandish, but I think that's the direction where this goes.
And how do you see the future of the regulatory landscape for psychedelics looking? You know, when you look at something like cannabis, what's been clear is that regulators often are quite limited in their capacity to understand alien topics, so wanting to sort of apply it to previous models. You know, we have cannabis, let's regulate it like guns or alcohol or tobacco. It's like, no, it needs to be regulated slightly different. And actually mentioning alien topics, even sort of how people, you know, depict aliens, you know, a normal person drawing a picture of an alien essentially draws a human with a slightly bigger head and makes him green and says, hey, that's an alien. You know, us as people, we're quite limited in things that we don't understand. I guess sort of looking at psychedelics, how do you see the best way to regulate it, which is best for regulators, that's best for patients and best for everyone? Is it in the model of cannabis? Is it in the model of guns? Or is it something different? What do you think?
I think guns and psychedelics should be sold in the same stores. No, I'm just kidding. You know, to go back to the answer is I don't know. You know, we need to learn. And I think that's the most important thing, that this is going to be incremental. And things will evolve. And that's the best way to do it, not to presume that we have all the answers right now, because we don't and we never will. I started reading a book called Homo Deus. I forget the author's name, but
Yuval something.
Exactly. And what he talks about is that, you know, trying to predict the future is so hard, because what becomes relevant as things change, like as soon as you decide something or realize something, it changes the course of the future, right? So it's really hard to predict how things evolve. And I think the same thing is here, right? Like in Ontario, where I'm based, 20, maybe not 25 years ago, call it 30 years ago, the liquor store where you could buy alcohol, which was provincially run, you know, it was not branded. It was, you'd walk in and there was a desk and you'd fill out a piece of paper and you'd write down what you want. And they'd come back and they'd put it in a paper bag. And then you'd walk home kind of like through a walk of shame by virtue of the fact that you had just had the audacity to buy alcohol. And now, you know, the LCBO, which is the liquor store in Ontario, is, you know, a beautiful, open, bright space where all the products are branded and there's marketing and all this kind of stuff. So we see how things evolve, that people are pretty resistant to alcohol being a central part of our society. And you know, we can argue the merits of whether that's good or not, but it clearly evolved and people's fears around it slowly abated. And now it's just a part of our society. And I think the same thing happens with psychedelics. I think personally, the model being proposed in Oregon is a great place to start, you know, which is they're creating access to psilocybin therapies. You don't have to be depressed or anxious. So it's not purely a medical system. But they're going to ensure quality and security of supply. They're going to establish training such that the only way to access it is through a psilocybin therapy service. So you're not buying it and taking it home and tripping out. You're doing it in the context and the auspices of a controlled environment with a, you know, licensed professional, exactly what license is required to be determined. But you really minimize the downside risk of a bad trip for people doing something really stupid when on a psychedelic, and maximize the potential impact, because you don't have to be depressed or anxious, which would, you know, exclude me because I don't have a clinical diagnosis from accessing psilocybin therapies in a purely medical system. And I think that's a great place to start. Now, whether that evolves to a cannabis model where people can just go to their average store and buy some mushrooms and do an experience on their own, I'm pretty skeptical that that would happen, but it's a possibility. But what's proposed in Oregon is a good place to start, because I think most people, you know, even those people who are opposed to liberalization of access to psychedelics, can get their heads around a model being very controlled and limiting access and really minimizing the downside. It's going to take a lot longer for people to get to a place where you can go and buy a psychedelic and take it home and have an experience. But we may get there. But, you know, let's be incremental. Let's test. Let's evolve. Let's be thoughtful about this. And I think we'll get to the right balance between trying to minimize risk as well and maximizing benefit.
Well, I think that's probably about all we've got time for. So, Ronan, I just want to say, thank you for being a wonderful guest on Professionally Psychedelics. We've really enjoyed having you on. And I guess we'll have to bring you on when this molecule comes out and you can give us the exact description of what it's like when the moiety breaks apart and it releases and it's gone through all of those things that I don't quite understand.
Well, you know, for those who are willing to ignore narcotic control rules, you know, later this year, the underlying molecule that we're working off of will be disclosed because our patent application will be published, and then people will be able to go out and try it for themselves if they wish, which I, you know, certainly don't advocate. But I also respect people's decisions to be autonomous creatures and do what they think is appropriate for them. So,
please take me above. Take me with you.